Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Sandeep Roy, editor with New America Media, and host of Upfront on KALW 91.7 FM. This program is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Find us at commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for this evening. Childhood memories of pig's head for Christmas dinner, kids dying of consumption, fathers drinking the dole money, are usually destined to end up on a therapist's couch. But by some feat of literary alchemy, Frank McCourt turned what he described as a miserable childhood, a miserable Irish Catholic childhood, to be precise, into literary gold. Angela's Ashes became a literary sensation, winning him the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. And he followed it up with more stories from his life in Tiz and Teacher Man. His latest book is Angela and the Baby Jesus, and it's described as a children's book, but as befits a man who wrote about eating pig's head for Christmas, it's a Christmas story with a twist. The baby Jesus gets kidnapped from his crib. Please welcome author and former teacher Frank McCourt.
Thank you, Sandra. I want to say that people who have cell phones, if the cell phone goes off, answer it and tell them where you are.
And tell them to buy the book?
Tell them to buy the book and send money to the Commonwealth Club and participate in its programs. Why waste a golden opportunity like that? I was on a cable program in Los Angeles yesterday. And I hate cell phones, but I got one recently because of all the traveling. And as we were ending the program, my cell phone went off in my pocket, and I wanted to go up in Calvary and crucify myself. I felt sorry. I know that one will surely go off tonight because somebody's son or daughter is expecting a baby. And that's excuse. There are other excuses, but answer it and tell them you're at the Commonwealth Club.
No, I'm sorry I gave away the mystery, if it's a mystery, about the kidnapping of the baby Jesus. But I read that this is a story that your mother told you every Christmas?
Yeah. Oh, no, she didn't turn it into a Christmas story. We weren't that ritualistic about stories. It's a story she told about something that happened to her when she was 6 years old. We'd be sitting around the fire, and she'd tell the story. My father would tell stories. He'd make up stories. He'd create mythical heroes. He'd make up stories about people next door, Mr. King and Mrs. Reedy. They became favorite characters of him. And the story usually started in a pub around the corner, and the pub would close, and Mr. King and Mrs. Reedy would come out staggering along the street, and they'd have some kind of adventure. And he then create stories about famous Irish heroes. And I love the stories he told about Irish rebels who were sentenced to death and hanged. Because he was very good at describing the hanging and how the noose was placed and the floorboard and the body dropped. And at least the English hanged, they didn't tear their heads off like the Iraqis when they hanged that guy who, I suppose you know about that. I don't want to get into politics. But my mother would tell stories which were more personal. She'd tell stories about herself and about her brothers and sister, and about neighbors and her own experiences. She could become more intimate, if you want to call it, although the Irish are a very reticent people. My father would never talk about his family.
Irish are very reticent
people? Reticent, yeah, you wouldn't believe it. I know, you're looking at me askance.
But and when did you write? Did you write it down much earlier? Or
no, she would tell that story, and then there was my brother Maliki. A few years later, my brother Mike was born. He had to hear the story, and then a few.
Oh, this
years,
is like watching Sound of Music.
Yeah.
Every time a new cousin was born, you know, grew old enough, we had to go see the Sound of Music.
Friends of mine would come into the house and they say, Mrs. McCord, tell us the story about the baby Jesus. And she'd tell it. And we'd sit around the fire. It sounds almost primitive the way we lived. We'd sit around the fire. If we had money, it would be coal. Otherwise, it was turf, which is peat, or sometimes wood. But we'd sit around the fire in the evening. And nights are very long in Ireland. The days are very long in the summertime. And we'd sit there with our tea, and she'd tell these stories, and we were enchanted. For instance, when my father had a friend, Christy Morn, and he'd come on Saturday nights, and he'd sit, he had one eye in a patch over his eye, and he was a little fella, and he'd sit on a three-legged stool. And my father and Christy would talk, and I thought, my God. And I used to sneak out of bed and sit on the stairs listening to them. And my mother would say, are you up? Are you sitting on the stairs? And I'd say, no. and then she said, go to bed. And I'd go back to bed and I'd come down. Because I found the talk of grown-ups fascinating. That doesn't hold anymore. The talk of grown-ups kids now and teenagers don't give a damn what you talk about. They don't want to hear your story. So we're living in it. But I think we were enriched by the stories of my father and my mother and adults in general. We love listening to them.
So with this particular book, why are there two illustrated versions?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't the foggiest idea. That's a publisher's decision. The little book is for the big people, and the big book is for the little people. So that's. And the little book is Christmas card size, and I think they're making envelopes so you can send it off as a Christmas card. Extra postage, of course. And the big book has bigger pictures, and I suppose you can read it to the kids, and while you're reading, show it to them in a semi-dark room.
And and this particular story, you've carried it with you all your life because your mother told you so many times. Why did you? What prompted you to set it down now?
I carried it. I left Ireland when I was 19 and came to New York. And when I started teaching in a vocational high school in New York, my students just, you know how they are. You might be thinking of doing a lesson on grammar, on that fascinating thing called the dangling participle, and. And they knew what was coming up, and they tried to get you off the subject. So, yo, Mr. McCourt, Mr. McCourt, what games did you play in Ireland? You know, Mr. McCourt, y'all Catholics over there in Ireland, and they tried to get you off. And then I would tell a few anecdotes, and I didn't want you. I was warned by older teachers, don't tell them anything. Tell them nothing, because you have a right to privacy. They seemed sincere. I knew they were 50% sincerely interested, 50% to get me away from the dangling parasol. So I would tell them these stories, and this is one of the stories that came up, Angel and the Baby Jesus, and they were interested, but it didn't mean much to them because they never had that experience of. I saw they'd gone to church all right, a lot of them. These Italian kids that I had in Staten Island, they got to church at Christmas and they probably see the nativity scene and this baby Jesus and so on. But it meant more to us in Ireland because there were 8 churches in a city of 50,000 people, Limerick. And we'd go from church to church to church to church to church to check out the nativity scene, just to see which was the best of all. And we used to award them prizes, you know. In our heads, and this was all significant for us. Jesus in the manger in Bethlehem.
But I was surprised when I first read Angelus Ashes is that your relation. Well, you described churches as a place where people would go to a lot because it was the only dry place during the rainy season, and it rained a lot there.
Churches and pubs.
Churches and
pubs. So we're friend of. Frantic with spirituality and alcoholism.
And what was your relationship with churches? Because it didn't seem like you were a big church-going family to start
with. Oh, we had to be. We had to be. We had to go to churches or the neighbors would talk. Nobody escaped. It was a tight little community, like pure.
Were you going to churches when you were in America, or did you restart back in Ireland?
Well, I was only going on four when I left New York for Ireland. And then you get over there, and Limerick is proud of being the holiest city in Ireland. And I used to say that the women are proud of the ferocity of their chastity. And their favorite word was no. So we grew up in there, and if you didn't go to Mass, you know, it's very hard to explain, especially to kids nowadays, of how guilty you felt all the time about sin, and that you had to go to confession. If you didn't go to confession, you had a mortal sin in your soul. And I look at the kids nowadays. When I was teaching in Stuyvesant High School, which is the best high school in New York City, I might be talking about James Joyce and the seven deadly sins, and they're looking at me, 80% Jewish kids, and they're looking at me, and I said to them, you don't know what the seven deadly sins are, do you? No. I said, how can you enjoy yourself if you, yes, unless you're sinning. So all of this is very, very heavy stuff. It made us miserable and guilty and so on, but it was also a rich experience because we had a sense of the history of churches and religion and so on. And then the ritual, the Christmas, Easter, Lent, and so all of that stuff. These were our chronological guideposts.
But then you, at some point, didn't you compare the church to the mafia?
Well, yeah.
And then you met the Pope after that.
Yeah, I did. Well, as
far did he bring it up?
The mafia, the church is like the mafia. Once you're in, there's no out. Yeah. It's like when you're baptized, as I said, in the mafia, you're made. And there's no way out except, as some of my Italian friends used to say, the only way out is to be encased in a block of concrete at the bottom of the Hudson River. That's the only way. And I met the Pope. I was living in Rome for a few years ago. I spent 3 months there. And a friend of mine who was a big shot in Israel, Uri Sevier. He was in the foreign affairs department in Israel. He formed this organization called the Global Forum. And he had this big international meeting of mayors in New York City. So he had known me in New York, so he invited me. He said, they're all going to meet the Pope. You know, usually when people go to meet, there's thousands of people, and maybe a few are allowed in. But in this case, there were only 40 people, mayors of Barcelona and Boston and Washington and Zanzibar and so all these mayors. So we're sitting in this room. It's about this size. It's magnificent, murals everywhere, beautiful, and waiting for the Pope, and the mayor of Rome is there, Veltroni. So the Pope is pushed in on this movable platform, and he's bent over. He was in bad shape, and he's tried to raise his hand to give the... I said, if this is what it brings you to, I'll never be Pope. he's trying to give the blessing, and then they put him up in the chair, and the mayors line up to meet the Pope, and I noticed that, and his hand was on a cushion, and the big ring was there, the big paper ring, which they break when he dies. So his hand is there, and the paper ring is gleaming, there were Muslim mayors that go up and shake his hand, and there were indifferent mayors, and they shake it. Then the Catholic mayors, like the one from Boston, Manini, I think he's Manini, he'll be mayor forever. He knelt and kissed the Pope's ring, and other Catholic mayors. And I said, what the hell am I going to do? When I get up, what am I going to do? I'm a lapsed Catholic, I suppose, a relapsed, doomed. But and I don't know what am I going to say to this man, the 264th occupant of the throne of Peter. What am I going to say? He's directly descended from Peter, who got the job from Jesus. So what am I going to say? So I got up there, and my wife was just ahead of me. And just ahead of her was the mayor of Belfast, Protestant mayor of Belfast, Jimmy Rogers. So I said, Jimmy, what's going to happen when the word gets back to Belfast that you're talking to the Pope? Ah, he said, my term is over in 2 weeks. So my wife is in front of me. She's from California. She was baptized Catholic, but she never practiced it. So she went up and shook his hand. And I get there, and there he is. Can you imagine standing in front of the Pope with a kind of... And inside me, there's a little Irish Catholic boy saying, kneel, you bastard, kneel. Kneel and kiss his ring. You know what you are. You know you're ready to poop in your pants with terror. And I knelt, and I took his hand, and I kissed his ring, and I got up. He's looking at me with his dazzling blue Polish eyes and his extraordinary complexion. And I looked at him, and I had a feeling. He knew. He knew what a fraud and a phony I was. So I walked away. And I have to admit, as turbulent as my relationship with the church has been, though they don't know it, they don't care. It's been turbulent in my... I was walking on water, practically. I was walking on air. And my wife said, did you kiss his ring? I said, yeah. Didn't you? No, she said, I'm not going to kiss that ring with all that lipstick and snot.
Well, you should have had practice, because don't you write about how you prefer to go to confession with this really elderly priest?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I used to go, when you were a kid and you entered that terrible domain called adolescence and you begin to sin in various private ways, you wander around, you're terrified all the time because you know you're sinning. So we went around looking for priests, easy priests, I say, who'd be merciful. So... And somebody told me there was this priest who was about 99 years old, Father Tubridy, and he was as deaf as a turnip. And you'd go in and you kneel down, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. This is a week or 2 weeks since my last confession. And you notice that there's a little slide that pulled back, a little pen, and I looked at he was nodding off. And I'm telling him my sins. I got more outrageous because he didn't care. He was sleeping. He was nearly dead anyway. So then he'd give me, blessing, absolve a day, and he'd give me absolution and tell me he said three Hail Marys and three Our Fathers. And that went on for about a year. Then I went in one afternoon. It wasn't my man at all. It was some young guy with big ears that could hear everything. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Ah, my child, and what sins have you committed? Says, well, Father, and then we were well trained in language. The worst sin was the breaking of the Ten Commandments, which is thou shalt not commit adultery. Now we were 9 or 10 years or 11, 12, but adultery was defined as bad thoughts, bad words, bad deeds, which we boil down to dirty things in general. So, and I said, bless me, Father, for I've said, and what sin? I said, I did dirty things, Father. Ah, my child, alone, or with another, or with some class of beast. I said, my God, this man is opening new horizons today. I never looked at a sheep the same way again. Could be a member of my family.
You can never say the church didn't open your eyes.
This is the beginning of my slow decline into agnosticism.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with author Frank McCourt. Now, one of the things that struck me, and you've talked about this before, is when did you start actually thinking that many of the, what you call the miserable things that happened in your childhood, the poverty, the alcoholism, it wasn't just stuff that one was ashamed of and didn't talk about in front of company, but that You know, but that you could write about it and it would be of interest to other people.
Well, I never thought it would be of interest. When I was growing up, I read mostly smart-ass English authors like Aldous Huxley and Evelyn Waugh. My favorite author was a man named P.G. Woodhouse. I read P.G. Mm-hmm. Woodhouse starting at 10 or 11, and I read him all my life. I still, when I get down in the dumps, I read The Adventures of Jeeves and Bertie Wooster. That was my literature. And then there was Mark Twain. Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. I thought they were glorious stuff. But I never thought about writing what my teachers never said, you know, your story is valuable. You could write about it. Oh, no, no. They told us we were instilled with shame. My mother was ashamed of being poor. The poor were ashamed of being poor. And you don't come out of a slum walking tall the way they do in the movies, fighting you. No, you don't. You slink out. And you're furtive, and you look at other kids. You look at other kids at Christmas comes, and they have new bicycles, and you have new shoes and all of that. And you have a sense of hopelessness, but you're dreaming of getting out of that slum. You look up the lane to the top of the lane. You say, someday I'll go up there and go down to the railway station, and I'll never come back. That's what kept us going. But the shame was powerful, and it takes you years and years and years to get over. Whatever damage you suffer in childhood or adolescence takes an awful long time to heal.
Did you worry, though, then after Angela's Ashes became such a phenomenon that you could have the flip side of it where the poverty could suddenly become something almost exotic?
Well, for some people, it might be exotic, but getting up in the morning and freezing to death is not exotic, and having your father come home drunk with no money is not exotic. I suppose it is a strange story. Because very little is written about poverty. You see it on television. You see Darfur, you see Chad, and so on. And that's African poverty. And the children are staring into the camera, and their little bellies are swollen. The mothers are trying to nurse them, and there's nothing left to give. And you see this all the time, and you always become accustomed to it. But the psychological damage of poverty in this country, or any place else, is what is the poverty that lasts. You can send in rice and so on, feed the people and so on. That doesn't heal them. They might be given some energy, but beware of giving energy to desperate people. They're going to use it. So this is the part that I'm interested in. What I'm thinking of is the kids nowadays who are starving around the world, and the anger that's going to accompany them into their young manhood and their middle age and the rest of it, and it's festering. And that, I think, that's the biggest problem. The hunger is bad, and people should be fed, but then you'd need about 9 million therapists who would never be equipped anyway. It's like those therapists when there's a disaster in a town. They fly in all these grief counselors, and the people say, will you leave us alone? And the grief counselors are not encouraged. If I saw a grief counselor, I'd jump off a cliff.
A couple of questions about emigration. And, you know, in Angela's Ashes, you have this great line where your grandmother, I guess, tells your mother, why don't you go to America where there's room for all sorts of uselessness?
Yeah.
And then you have, towards the end of the book, you have this marvelous scene where you're looking at the River Shannon and you're thinking that if I can't get back to America, if I can't go there, I might as well just throw myself into the river. So the question that I have here is, with the prosperity of the Celtic tiger, Irish people no longer need to emigrate from Ireland to seek work. However, is the current materialistic Ireland losing its heart and soul?
That's a good question, because sometimes people say to me, if I go to Ireland, where will I find the real Ireland? And it's hard anymore, because one of the Ireland's natural gifts was the pub. Not because of the alcohol or anything. People were going, a man would have a pint or two or three pints. And the amazing thing about the Irish is they don't seem to have any bladders. I used to see men sitting at 3, 4, or 5 pints, and finally, reluctantly, they'd get up and go to the John, afraid they might miss something. The arguments, there were always political arguments, and there were always stories. But now the country's booming. I was in Ireland about 3 weeks ago. Half the population of Limerick is Polish. There's a big Lithuanian population. There are Czechs everywhere. It's hard to find an Irishman doing an honest day's work anymore. And I was saying to a man I met in a plane today, and he's from Dublin, how do you live? He said, we're up to here in debt, he said. Well, who cares? But so this is the Celtic Tiger. It's a country that just won the lottery overnight, and I think they're handling it well. Maybe chickens will come home to roost. But I think they're handling it well, and they're handling immigration. There's a shuttle, a daily shuttle, that goes from Dublin to Dubai. They're so heavily invested in Dubai. And they're buying condominiums in Manhattan and Miami and all over the world. And it is becoming more materialistic, but it's their time.
But would you say that now, in some ways, Ireland is a more optimistic country than America? Even?
Oh, well, yeah, they're optimistic. There's always that element or ingredient of spirituality and a sense that this is not the real thing. There's always something else, because they love to talk. They still love to talk, although the pubs are not what they used to be. There's an awful lot of binge drinking. They're drinking something called cosmopolitans. And there's terrible slaughter on the highways. They're driving like maniacs. But the church that we've talked about a minute, the church is almost collapsing. There are cardinals there and archbishops and bishops and priests and so on. But there's been an awful lot of scandal with the pedophilia, and the churches are closing down, the orphanages are closing down and so on. Nobody is joining the priesthood anymore. When I was a kid, on Monday morning, you'd see in the Irish Independent or Irish Press, you'd see an account of how many priests had been ordained the Sunday before, the day before, usually 30 to 60. Last year, one priest was ordained in Ireland. So what you have, nuns, I don't know if the girls are certainly not going into the convents. If you go to Ireland, as what you see in Rome, the nuns you see in Rome are little ones that size, Filipinos. And this is where the church is going to get its clergy from now, India, Africa, Latin America. Because the Irish discovered the joys of sex. And the whole country might be turned Episcopalian, because at least the Episcopalians can get married. I would, if I had to do it over again, I'd be an Episcopalian priest. What a life! And you get respect, and you give them hellfire and damnation every Sunday morning, and you have seven children.
You've addressed some of this already about how has Limerick changed since you left, but the follow-up question to it is, would you think of retiring there?
Oh, no, I couldn't afford Ireland now. even though I've made the ironic thing is you have a miserable childhood and you write a book about it, and then they give you money for telling the story of your miserable childhood. But I think I reached the end of my tether when I was in Dublin a couple of weeks ago at the Shelbourne Hotel, which is newly renovated, and I was meeting a cousin of mine, and I had a glass of wine, an ordinary Cabernet, for 16 euros. I said, that's it for me. I couldn't live there. I met Americans, older Americans who retired there years ago on their Social Security and their pensions, which are now worth half of what they used to be before. So they're thinking of coming back to the land of the free and the home of the brave and cheap.
The dollar can go a little further.
This is a cheap country compared with Europe.
It's true. But how are you treated in Limerick these days? I'd read that the Limerick Leader, when Angela's ashes had come out, they weren't too happy with how their city was portrayed. In fact, they called it a tissue of lies.
A tissue of, yeah. Well, they're very eloquent to the Limerick Leader. So they weren't too happy with my depiction of Limerick. It was my story. I came from that particular background, the slums of Limerick. And some people said, it was never like that at all. Then other people, it seems suddenly a million people lived next door to us. And then Alan Parker, who directed the movie of Angel's Ashes, put out a call for extras. All these people who objected to my depiction of Limerick are now crowding around, lining up to be in the movie. And there were going to be small children, babies in the movie. There were pregnant women begging them to delay the movie till after their babies were born so they could. And then I was given an honorary degree by the University of Limerick the book sold, the movie sold. And then I went back a couple of weeks on it, signing Angela and the Baby Jesus in a bookshop. Oh, it's all different. And what they were saying was, well, they look at him. He's getting on in years. He knows the end is near. So he's looking for redemption.
So no statue for you like Richard Harris?
Oh, God, I went to see Richard Harris' statue, and I just burst out laughing. If they ever do that to me, I'll come back and haunt them. He's got up as King Arthur. He's standing there in his side street in Limerick holding a sword and a crown. That wasn't Richard Harris. He made one movie where he was King Arthur, so he stuck with that for eternity.
Well, this, I guess, could follow from the question about the reaction in Limerick. Did you fear repercussions from family members, especially when you were writing the second and third books?
No, the family seemed to be okay with it, unless they're talking behind my back, and they probably are. But I talk behind their back, so just in case. I don't want to let them get away with anything. So it was all right. There were no repercussions. I wouldn't have written that book while my mother was alive. She would have been, again, there was the shame. You just don't reveal yourself like that. But only she got the confession. That was the only time where you could reveal yourself. That's why I always thought therapy was unsatisfactory for Catholics. Because you got the confession and your soul is cleansed. You walk out, you could be hit by a truck and you go to heaven. But therapy, it goes on and on and on. And it costs $150 or $300 an hour. And priests are free.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And we are talking with author Frank McCourt. When you left Ireland at the age of 19 and you'd saved up all this money, partly from writing threatening letters to people to pay up for, was it a clothing?
She was a loan shark.
She was.
Yeah, Mrs. Finucane, yeah.
And did you feel that in some ways your emigration, your leaving your mother and your family there was an act of betrayal?
Oh, no. To leave would give people hope. When anybody left to go to England, so it was understood they were going to send money home, and that would relieve the when I went to the States, and I didn't have much money to send home, but I was drafted into the United States Army. I was saved by the Chinese because they attacked Korea, and America got nervous and turned to me, and drafted me. And sent me to Germany, where for 2 days I was put into the canine corps, training attack dogs, German shepherds. And that was very good preparation for my future career as teacher. And while I was in the army, they had this dependent benefits thing. I would send home half of my powerful monthly pay. So my mother got about, I think, $126 a month, which was an awful lot of money in Ireland at the time. That kept her going. Then my other brothers went into the army after me. And that was the tradition. Somebody goes to England, somebody goes to America, you make money, you send for the next one, and they send for the next one, and so on down the line. So, I mean, parting was sweet sorrow, all right, but there was hope when people were waving goodbye. They were waving us. Half their wave was goodbye and don't forget to send money.
Since you brought up army as prep ground for teaching, is this question, do you miss teaching?
Yeah, I do, but I wouldn't have the patience or the energy. Most people don't realize in the public high schools in New York and so, in Chicago and so on, if you teach English, you teach five classes a day, in addition to having something called a homeroom or a building assignment. The building assignment might be go around and check the boys' rooms to make sure they're not up to something. And they're always up to something. and you just let it go after a while. But you have five classes a day, and how can you teach 175 kids? It still bedevils me that the public don't know about this, because when anything goes wrong with the school, blame the teachers. When Sputnik went up, I think it was 1957, this little Russian golden ball that went through the sky, and everyone, oh, well, how the hell did the Russians get that little golden ball up there? And we don't have a little golden ball up there. It's somebody's fault, yes, the teachers. There's something wrong with public education. So when in doubt, every September, all the magazines come out, Time, Newsweek, and so on, whining about public education, and it's usually traced back to these incompetent teachers.
So when you became a teacher, did you miss the fact that, unlike in Ireland, you couldn't practice corporal punishment?
Oh, you could not in New York City? But I was teaching McKee High School, where they had a football team. Some of the kids were 230 pounds. They could have broken me in two. Oh, sit down, Jose. What? I'm telling you, sit down. Who are you going to make me? You learn very early to leave your ego at the door. That's the main thing. You cannot respond to them all the time, because they have ways of getting at you. And this is what we forget. They're geniuses. They're veterans of the schoolrooms. And nobody writes about this, how they've been in school all their lives. They've been in school since they were five or something like that. And by the time they reach 15 or 16, they know more about human psychology and school psychology than you do. They could run rings around you. I learned from them.
How do you think back to your school days? Because the writer Vikram Seth was once invited to his old school to give away prizes or something. And he kind of horrified everybody by giving a speech basically saying about how miserable he was in school and telling the students, if you're miserable, don't worry, it does get better after this.
After school,
after
yeah,
school.
It does, yeah. Well, I don't see why kids should be miserable in school. I don't see any reason why the schools can't be joyous places. It's this gloomy, bureaucratic approach to education, engendered mainly by politicians who are enemies generally of the human race. And they're the ones who control the purse strings. That's the only reason they have that power. But if you're a teacher, if you go into a classroom every day, you don't want to be miserable. So I did my best to enjoy myself. I'd say to the kids, if I don't enjoy myself in this classroom, you're in trouble. You're fair.
Now, while you were teaching, did you have the urge to write or be a writer at all? And if so, how did you pass the years until you were really able to write? And this person wants some advice for aspiring writers who feel as if they need to wait until they can write.
I was writing when I was 7 or 8 years old, as soon as I learned to put words together, just for my own enjoyment, because I thought it was magic. Getting these letters and putting them together and making words and then sentences and so on and paragraph. And I'd write little plays that I forced my brothers to act in the plays. My brother Maliki and Mike and Alfie went. And I wrote a play where somebody had to be hanged. And nobody was volunteering, so we took Alfie, the baby, and hung him on a nail. And he was officially hanged. And my mother came home. She said, "Where's the child?" And we all forgot where we put him. So we had to go. We found him hanging on a nail. But I was always writing. And then you start teaching, and you don't have time. You teach five classes a day, and you have papers to correct. You take the bag home, and you put it down, and you put it over there. And you're always conscious of it. These damn papers have to be corrected. And you sit down, you have to have a glass of wine, and it's over there like an old dog glaring at you, that bag of papers. And I was like, I should have become a college teacher. I should have gone to university where they teach about 2 minutes a week and complain. College teaching is the greatest racket in the world. It's because you have all the time to write books. They all write books, and nobody reads them but other college teachers who have to read them because they're writing unreadable books too. So the general public doesn't. But high school teachers just don't have time. I tried. I scribbled in notebooks. And that's the thing that saved me, I think. And that's what I tell young people who want to write. Don't try to write. Scribble. Keep scribbling, like the sculptor with his block of granite. Just keep scribbling, and something will emerge from your scribbling.
What kind of advice would you have for young writers, especially ones who, you know, you famously wrote that a happy childhood is hardly worth your while. Yeah. So it must be somewhat sobering to some people who want to write a memoir but feel like their life was just too, well, not dramatic enough.
Yeah, well, too much food. I would say a friend of mine worked for Time magazine for, 30 years, and he was retired, or he was fired, as I say. Or, no, we say he was made redundant. It's another one of these euphemisms, like passing away. So he was made redundant, and he said to me, Frank, you know, he said, I'd like to write a memoir, but I grew up happy in Scarsdale, which is a rich community outside New York. I said, my God, Brian, my heart bleeds for you. You want to write a memoir? I said, I have the solution, right? Write a memoir with the title A Happy Childhood, subtitled In Search of Misery. You can find misery. Most of us are capable. You know, when things are going well, we always find something to be miserable about. And it's hard work trying to be happy. I don't believe in happiness anyway, I don't think. It's so much of an American pastime, this search for happiness. Just forget happiness. Enjoy your misery.
Well, you know, I had a fairly happy childhood, but I remember when I was very little, I used to pretend I was adopted.
May I offer my condolences? You pretend you were adopted.
I used to pretend I was adopted. It added a little more drama. Otherwise, it felt so, I don't know, so...
Did you tell your parents about this?
No, I didn't really mention it. It was much more interesting to tell friends about.
So you thought you were a very mysterious figure.
Yeah, then they thought I was kind of mysterious.
You could have been the son of a prince or something like that.
I could have been, but instead.
Yeah. I was descended from the kings of Ireland.
Here's a question from a listener who wants to ask you, given that you'd written so much about your father's alcoholism, were you ever affected by the pint during your life?
No. No, there was never. No, I didn't. I don't think I had trouble with alcoholism. I drank my share and so on. But then, when I became a teacher, my life in New York, I had a rich social life. I'd go to bars and so on. Got to Irish dances, I'd ask a girl to dance, and they always said no. Yeah, and once in a while they would, and they said they're tired of clumping around and me stepping on their feet, so on. But and then there was the drink. I'd go to bars, and maybe I'd overdo it. But then I became a teacher, and I used to hang around in Greenwich Village in a bar called the Lion's Head with a lot of journalists like Pete Hamill and Norman Mailer used to come in, and so on. So I became a teacher then. I used to stay out late before I became a teacher. Maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and make my way back to Brooklyn, which is an hour away. But then I started teaching, and I tried to continue my same habits. But then I'd go into school. I used to take a ferry from Manhattan to Staten Island, where I was working, and I'd get on that ferry, and I was so hungover. I remember kneeling on the deck one morning, asking God to take me. I could have jumped over the side, but I wanted him to take me. I was so desperate. Then I'd go into the class, and the kids, as I said, they're psychologists. Then, hey, yo, Mr. McCourt, you don't look too good, huh? So I knew I couldn't do that. Maybe on the weekends I'd go out, and maybe on a Saturday night. But I never became an alcoholic in the sense that I longed for it or that I needed it to sustain me.
But what did you tell the story? I mean, I found it one of the really touching stories in Among the Many in Angela's Ashes about your first pint.
Yeah.
And you know, and the fact that your father wasn't there.
Yeah, yeah. My aunt's husband, Pat Reed, and it was kind of a ritual in what you might call lower class families. The first pint, which it wasn't a good night for me. It's in the book if you want to know. It's available in all fine bookstores.
What was it like watching a young kid play you in the film?
Oh, there were three. And three different kids. It was fascinating. First of all, you're flattered that somebody wants to make a movie of your life. And you sit there. I went with my wife to the screening. And, of course, she had a big boxes of Kleenex. And I was close to tears myself. The idea of all of this whole story coming on the screen in New York and Hollywood and so on, it was very moving. And a lot of people found fault with the film, but I was just flattered that it was done. And I think Alan Parker, the director, did a sweet job.
But when you were watching it, did it feel like your story or did it feel like a film?
Yeah, well, it was authentic. So it didn't feel like a film. You're sitting there and you're watching a movie about yourself, and you're aware of yourself watching the movie about yourself. So I was in awe of the very fact that powerful people in Hollywood, Scott Rudin and David Brown, decided to do this and got these terrific actors. And then the boys, they got three boys to play me, and of course they were all impeccably handsome like me.
did you get to meet them?
Oh, yeah, I met them. I met them in Dublin. I went on the set where they were doing a scene in a school, and then I met them at the premiere, the screening in New York, the premiere. And now they just completed the script for Teacher Man. And they're looking around, they're thinking of all kinds of handsome actors to play me.
Who would you like?
The actor I like is one who's not that well-known in America, Cillian Murphy. He was in a movie called The Wind That Shakes the Barley that came out to much controversy in England last year. And then the man who wrote the script, I had dinner with him last night in Los Angeles. And you wouldn't believe the names they're tossing around. Johnny Depp. Sean Penn. And Jodie Foster is reading the script with a view to directing it. So I sit there. I think, geez, I wrote about my miserable childhood, and now they're making this guy who wrote the script won the Oscar for Rain Man, Ron Bass. So I can't believe. I should have written about my miserable childhood much earlier in life. But it wouldn't work because if I got any kind of money or fame, I would have been dead of whiskey and fornication all the time.
So one of the listeners wants to know, when you come to San Francisco now, are you introduced as Mike McCourt's brother?
Yeah. But he's legendary. Because when Herb Cain was around writing his column, if he ever needed a quote for the quote for the day, he'd go up to Mike. Sometimes I meet people in my travels and say, go see my brother Mike in the Washington Square Bar and Grill. And sometimes they go and see him. And Mike Mike will use a four-letter expletive connection with me. Because I love to meet boring people in play and say, you have to see my brother Mike, because it drives him. But people will come in to Mike and they say, Mike, did you hear the one about... I did. I had. Mike has heard the one about everything.
I wanted to talk a little bit about storytelling. Because when we started this conversation, you were talking about your father and your mother and their own styles of telling stories, and the fact that that was, in a way, a form of entertainment, even.
Yeah.
How was it different with your own daughter? Were you a big storyteller?
Yeah, she wouldn't listen to me. No, I'm sorry. She did. Because I used to make up stories about her flying around with her friend and so on. She listened to me. She still listens. I think she listens anyway. She looks very attentive. But she's 36 now. She has a daughter who's 14, Kiara, and who don't want to pay any attention to me whatsoever. So she doesn't know what she's missing. She'll be sorry someday when I get the Nobel Prize. But you know, This is what made me sad when I was teaching. I'd go into the class in the morning and stand up there near my desk, and the kids would come in talking about what they watched the night before, what they watched on television. And I said, it wasn't like that when we were going to school. First of all, we weren't allowed to talk in the classroom. But if we did talk in the hallways, it was about what we did the night before. We didn't watch anything. There was nothing to watch anyway. Sometimes we always wanted to go to the movies, which we called the pictures. And we'd say, Dad, could we go to the pictures? He said, look at the pictures on the wall. The only picture he had was Pope Leo the 13th. So we'd look at Pope Leo. But we didn't...
And your mother didn't want that in the bedroom or
something? No, no. She didn't want Leo staring down at her. Although he was a great pope and so on. That's all in Angel's Ashes, which is available in fine bookstores.
And what was your relationship with the movies, especially as a family that moved back from America to Ireland? Yeah. And, you know, for most of the people in Limerick, America was probably a place that existed in the movies.
This is where we got our knowledge of America, through the movies. And when I was a kid, there were two types of movies: gangster movies and westerns. Our hero was James Cagney. I wanted to come to America and be a gangster like James Cagney and get electrocuted in Sing Sing, because I knew that beautiful women would be inconsolable and weeping. I had this dream of just riding around the prairie and killing Indians with John Wayne. That's what we... Because America seems so broad and wide and sunny. So this is what we... There didn't seem to be any poverty in America. Even if you saw movies about the dead-end kids and so on, everybody seemed to be... Everybody had terrific teeth. There were no cavities. Cavities wouldn't dare come to America. So this was our idea. And then what really fascinated me was when... Well, you look at a scene where people are eating and they're ignoring the food or pushing it away. And I said, they're making that up. That couldn't be. So my brother Malachi and I decided that we go to America and we go from Maine to California, knocking on doors, looking for the leftovers. You wouldn't have to do anything else. But America, this is how we learned about America. And I think we were also fanatically interested in America. And I think the Irish in Ireland knew more about American history and politics and everything than Americans themselves.
What do you think about the relationship now here of Irish Americans with Ireland? How's that changing?
Well, the Irish Americans don't know what to make of Ireland because a lot of them are very... They're very innocent. They go up to Ireland looking for colleens, dimple colleens, milking cows and so on, leprechauns leaping all over the place and fairies and so on. People wearing little green plastic hats the way they do on St. Patrick. No, it's not like that at all. No, the Irish have no patience. You'd never hear anybody in Ireland say, top of the morning. Never. How are you today, lad? You know, there are Americans who put on that accent. How are you today? Isn't that a grand day? Top of the morning, lad. And you're going to go out and get drunk now. So the Irish are very sophisticated. It's an educated race. Dell computers are there in the west and Intel on the east. And they're traveling all over the place. And now, if you want to put money, want to make a lot of money, invest in Weight Watchers in Ireland. Obesity is a big problem in Ireland now. Flatulence, too.
Given that you've written so much about emigrating from Ireland, I was wondering how you view the current debate going on around the issues of immigration. One of the things many people don't know is that right here in San Francisco, there's actually a sizable population of undocumented Irish people here.
Yeah. I think they're gone back, though, mostly, the undocumented. Why should they hang around here when they can go back and live off the fat of the land? There used to be an awful lot of young Irish coming over here during the summer, clipping hedges and so on. They're all gone back now. This is a big thing going on in Ireland, the immigration problem. If you're a European, you can go to Ireland and work. There's nothing to stop you. But now you have Chinese and Nigerians coming into the country. The Nigerians coming in as political refugees, and they're allowed in. But you know, there are about an estimated 150,000 Polish citizens in Ireland. The Limerick Leader, which used to denounce me, now has a Polish page every weekend. I walk up the street in Limerick a few weeks ago, and on one side there's a Polish pub, and on the other side there's an African grocery store. And the Polish music is streaming out of the door of the pub, and the Africans are over there beating on bongo drums. I said, my God, what will my poor mother think of this?
And what kind of tension? Has the reaction to that been similar to some of the reactions here?
There isn't the same vitriolic reaction to the immigrants that we have here. There seems to be room. The population of Ireland is somewhat over 4 million, but there seems to be room for all these people coming in. The first wave was Romania, and they were not as inclined to settle down and work as the Poles and the Czechs and the Lithuanians. The Romanians, I saw a lot of them were Romani, they were gypsies, and they would take to the streets and beg. But they seem to be gone too. They're absorbed into the... And you look at school results now, they have these scholarship competitions, and you look at pictures in the Irish Times of these kids winning scholarships with the Chinese and Nigerians. It's fantastic. There's a town outside Dublin called Portlaoise. A few months ago, they elected, I think, a 47-year-old African from Nigeria as their mayor. And there he's this handsome man with his African wife and his four African daughters. And this is a big breakthrough.
So what do you think accounts for so much of the vitriol here in a country which constantly calls itself, you know, repeats ad nauseum that it's a nation of immigrants, and anyone running for political office always drags their immigrant grandmother out of the grave and says, they came...
Well, it's some kind of undefined fear, isn't it? At the root of all this is some kind of fear. I don't know. It's hard to find an answer to the...
Well, sometimes I wonder if it's a fear of loneliness, because I remember reading a story where this woman talks about how she joined the anti-immigrant group in her small town. And the main thing that really struck me about the story was she said, I have no one to play canasta with anymore because all the people in the houses around me have changed.
Don't Mexicans play canasta?
Apparently not with her.
They cheat anyway. You know how they are. Anybody who's undocumented cheats a canasta. This is well known. I remember you heard it here first. In the Commonwealth Club. Never play canasta with a Mexican. Ask for his documentation first.
Now, here's a sweeping question. From where do you draw your inspiration?
Oh, I don't. I don't have. I'm never inspired. You just reach into your experiences. I don't know what inspiration means anyway. When I started to write Angel's Ashes, I sat in a room by myself in an armchair like this with the board across it with my notebook and scribbling away in the notebook. And things would come some days, and other days things wouldn't come. So I'd write somebody a letter, or I'd write an abusive letter to the newspaper or something. Because people are always talking about writer's block. That's an American thing. You don't find Europeans talking about writer's block at all. Steve Martin defined writer's block as an excuse to go out and get drunk. So I didn't have any inspiration. My life is enough to depress me, but I'll use it.
But did you have a lot of people who, before you wrote Angela's Ashes, kept telling you, you must write a book?
Oh, yeah, the kids. My high school students, they were always telling me, are you going to... Well, I do what I'm told, and I wrote Angela's Ashes.
And when you started writing Angela's Ashes, did you start from what became the beginning of the book, or did you start with the story from somewhere else?
No, I don't know. I was making notes for years. I was scribbling in notebooks. For instance, I had Angela and the Baby Jesus in a notebook, And after Angel's Ashes and Tears were published, they kept asking me to write a children's story or a Christmas story or both. And I tried, and I couldn't do it. Then I remembered I had the story in a notebook. I sent it to them. I didn't have any expectations that they'd publish it. 3 weeks later, they said, you and Ellen, my wife, come down and look through children's books and choose illustrators. So that's how it happened. And this is the story as my mother told it. It's her story. Her name should be on the cover, not mine. Because and then I just it just came in almost in one piece.
Do you find, as you progressed writing Tiz and Teacher Man, did you find it harder or more easier to write about events that were closer to you as opposed to your childhood?
Harder. Angel's Ashes was almost written because I used to tell some of the stories when I was teaching, and I had some of them, scribbled some of them. And then I wrote Tiz, which is a mishmash of coming to a New York and getting jobs and trying to settle in and so on. But then I decided, I wrote a little about teaching in Tiz, but then I decided I hadn't written enough because so little is written about two things, poverty, as I said before, and teaching. You read, you look at these movies or read these books like, this one a few years ago I saw about Michelle Pfeiffer. She's in a high school in Los Angeles. Here she is, this drop-dead blonde goddess with all these Mexicans, the hostile Mexicans. But it is understood she was in the Marine Corps and she has a black belt, so don't mess around with Michelle. So, and then she's winning them over, but there's always one hostile, extremely handsome kid. And she has to win him over. And all of this stuff is going on. And I see all these teaching movies. And I said, this is strange. They only teach one class. The Blackboard Jungle, To Serve with Love, and Freedom Writers, and any other movie about teaching. One class. That's not realistic. I think Teacher Man, if the movie is ever made, it'll show teacher being exhausted at the end of the day, and 175 kids. Did you read my composition, Mr. McCourt? Did you read my composition? Well, I have to give it another look.
Which teacher would you look back to as having made the most difference to you?
There was one teacher in Limerick, Mr. O'Halloran. He was the last teacher I had in Limerick School. And he looked like FDR. He had a big head, and he wore, what do you call them, pince-nez? Pince-nez. And he had a big watch across his belly. And he said one time, and this got me into a lot, my boy, you have to go to America. All of you, leave Limerick. There's nothing here for you. And, of course, very people around Limerick were very upset over that. And then I wrote a composition one day, and he leans back and says, my boy, you are a literary genius. Well, you can imagine what it was like in schoolyard later. Oh, here he comes, McCourt, the literary genius. Say something genius, McCourt. Oh, there he comes. Write something, McCourt. Here, write something on the wall, McCourt. And then, of course, that went on and on. I was sorry I was ever called a literary genius, but maybe he was prophetic.
Do you remember what that composition was about?
The composition was about, I was writing a history of Ireland.
It was a small enough subject.
Yeah, just a whole history. I thought from the history of Ireland, from the earliest times to the day I was born, because history ended the day I was born.
So after that, so was the lesson that you drew from that when you became a teacher was not to call anybody in your class a literary genius?
Oh no, I had geniuses. I had kids that I was afraid of. They were so bright. I had one kid, Lisa, I won't tell you, she was a genius, and she was a poet, and she was equal to any, and she was 16, and then she went, you know, she became anorexic, and she'd come into class and put her head down, and then she recovered and went to Yale, and she'd call me from Yale two or three times. Frank, she's called me Frank. Frank, I just took an overdose. And I'd call the security people at Yale, and they'd get her and pump her out and so on. Then she called me one at 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, Lisa, if you want to do it, I'm not going to call security anymore. You don't care about me? Yes, and you're right. I don't care about you. You better start caring about yourself. So I said, then she didn't try it anymore. Then I meet her later on. She's graduated from Yale, magna cum laude, summa cum laude, all the laudes. And she has a job as a librarian at Newsweek. And that's. And then I said, you're writing poetry? Yes, she said, don't bother me. That was very sad.
So we've come to the point when there's time for only one question. So what are you working on now?
A novel. I'm writing a novel about my experiences in Brooklyn, certain people I knew. I have to be careful, too, because you have to be careful about ex-wives, particularly. But there are a number of them want to kill me. So I had to be careful with Tiz and Teacher Man. So I'm playing with the story. I would never again want to have a deadline. It's like being a kid in school has to have work in, and I wouldn't take an advance. This is one I'll enjoy, and I'll finish, and I'll be dead very soon. But you can all read this book, which is called Boylan's Brooklyn Bed and Breakfast. And it'll be on sale where? In all fine bookstores.
Our thanks to Frank McCord, former teacher and author. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program has been part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Sandeep Roy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.